I put a circle around general business because I forgot to put that bit different.
Oh, right. Okay.
I just did it all in capital.
Yeah, well, I'll sort of, I'll run that down.
Well, this is the wonder of the modern age.
Yeah.
Okay, I think Ted, what we need to do is just make sure that the slides line up properly with the screen.
Oh,
that'll be fine.
So you can move around a bit.
Perhaps while Ted's doing that, I'll just explain.
Lines down.
Oh, right, okay. Yes, we'll need to do that, I guess. That's not bad. A little bit of focus.
Is there much room there? Come back. Or I'll come back a little bit.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Okay, if you could just turn it off for the moment.
Can everybody see it? Or would they need it a bit higher?
Perhaps while all that's all this rearrangement going on, I'll just
excuse me, I think put that over there, it'll be out of everybody.
Okay. Actually, I could use this would be really good.
Yeah, you could use it.
Yes. I've often had a thought about, I suppose, to put it as most succinct, to enter the clergy, in that I rather fancy myself giving sermons. I did once have a secret desire to be the Bishop of Melbourne, but I think I've probably, the Anglican Bishop of Melbourne, but I've probably left my run a little late in this regard. But to continue on the rather personal note, I suppose I should, and in response to Valda's suggestion that I give a bit about my own background, I should start by saying, in regard to what I'm going to speak about today, how I came to acquire the information that I did. I suppose about, I'm just counting back years, about 13 years ago, maybe 14 years ago, I was employed to undertake a study of the archaeology of the Melbourne metropolitan area. And at that time I was working for the State Government of Victoria as an archaeologist, a wonderful little department called the Victoria Archaeological Survey, which unfortunately no longer exists. It was split in two, I think about 2 or 3 years ago, around about the time that the, not long after at least, the Kennett government was elected, and it was decided in their wisdom to split the archaeology department in two and to give some parts to one department and one ministry and some parts to another. But that's another story, I guess. In the all through the 1970s and into the 1980s, there was this department called the Archaeological Survey, and the director of the survey in about 1981 applied to the Australian Heritage Commission in Canberra to fund a 2-year study of the archaeological, the state of archaeology, archaeological sites in the Melbourne metropolitan region. And I was the fortunate person who was employed to undertake that survey. Now, it was a 12-month study with another 12 months to follow. So of that 12 months, I spent the first 3 months in acquiring, putting together information from essentially library sources, and also building up some understanding of the geology, the botany, the flora and fauna of the Melbourne area, as it might have been at the time that Europeans first arrived. What struck me immediately was that there had been an enormous amount of change to the landscape in that time, at that time it was less than 150 years of European settlement. And I was so struck by the dramatic nature of the change that had occurred to the landscape, that I decided when I finished the study at the end of the 12 months that it was something which I thought had general interest. And so I, having completed the study, and I'm looking now for my notes, having completed the study, I produced this report, which is the standard type of report that was required for the Australian Heritage Commission at the time, and every municipal council in the Melbourne metropolitan area received a copy of this. And I think there were only about 150 copies printed altogether, because that was all of the copies that were required for the purpose. But having completed that study, I decided that the information that I had was of much wider interest, and so I wrote a book about it. And that book was actually called The Land of the Kulin, but it and that was published in 1985. And 9 years later, it sold out. So Penguin, who had taken over the company that had produced the book in the first place, decided that they would reprint it, and it was republished in 1994 as Aboriginal Melbourne, and it is now getting close to being sold out again. That was in September 94. And in that intervening 2 years, they've sold something of the order of 2,500 copies of it. So it's a subject matter which I think is still of great interest to people, not only, of course, the changes to the landscape, but more and more, I think, the subject of Aboriginal studies, and particularly focusing on one's local area. And I guess that's what I've been asked to speak about today. I have to say that, firstly, that people often want to know what was going on or who was living in the area, in their immediate area, and if there are archaeological sites, Aboriginal sites recorded in their immediate suburb. In the vast majority of cases, say for the suburbs of Melbourne, the answer has to be that there aren't any sites recorded. But that's not to say, of course, that Aboriginal people were not in the area, that didn't live in the area. I mean, it is taken as read that Aboriginal people lived, or if not lived on a permanent basis, then certainly used every part of the area of Australia that is now called Victoria. That's simply taken as read. The difficulty, of course, in an area like Melbourne is that over the last 150-odd years that there's in many areas been an enormous amount of development, urban development, industrial, and originally, of course, farming development, and that has tended to destroy a large number, perhaps even the majority of archaeological or Aboriginal sites that one might otherwise have expected to find. Nonetheless, there are a lot of sites recorded around the Melbourne metropolitan area, and during my survey I recorded I think something like 40 more sites, even in areas that are now quite or comparatively densely populated. One has to focus on particular areas to be able to find them. You're not likely to find many sites, for instance, in the inner city suburbs, like Collingwood, Carlton, Richmond, Paran, Windsor. These places are so entirely built over and covered with concrete and tar that any evidence of Aboriginal settlement or Aboriginal use of the area is all but obliterated. Even so, of course, there are places like there are sites like the Scarred Tree or the Corroboree Tree in at Burnley Oval, which is quite clearly a tree which has some significance and tells us something about the Aboriginal way of life. What I guess I mostly want to speak about today is the people who would have been living in this area here. And I can tell you that there have been, I think, some a small number of sites recorded in the immediate vicinity. That mostly they are the type of site that you would expect to find would be trees from which a sheet of bark has been removed. And I'll speak more in a moment about the uses that this sort of artifact would have been put to. But also along Kunong Creek, there have been recorded sites where quite clearly people have been living for some period of time. The nature of archaeology in Australia is such that what tends to survive is, of course, the material such as stone. And so often the only indications we have that people lived anywhere is a scattering of small stone tools that have been made, or flakes of stone that have been created in the process of creating stone tools. And once again, I'll speak more about that in a moment. What one doesn't find is the organic remains in campsites. There's very little bone material, and artifacts that have been made from material such as wood or bone tend to deteriorate over a period of time. But a stone, of course, is virtually impervious to any natural process of degeneration. So although you might have, somebody might have stored a, say, a hatchet in their campsite over a period of hundreds of years, the wooden handle and the binding that would have been part of that hatchet would have disintegrated or rotted away, and what's left is just the axe head. So in a way, we are dependent for what we know about the Aboriginal way of life on recorded records, documents, eyewitness accounts, observations that people made when Europeans first came to this part of Victoria. So much of what I have to say about the Aboriginal way of life and the groups of people who were living, say, in this part of Melbourne, comes from a detailed study of those sorts of essentially historical accounts, and those accounts have been bolstered and underlined, I guess, with archaeological finds that have been made within the area. So if we have the first slide down. The people who lived in this part of Melbourne were part of a much larger organisation, an organisation of groups of people which covered all of the central part of Victoria. The title of the book that I originally wrote in 1985 was The Land of the Kulin. And Kulin was a word, an Aboriginal word, of course, that meant a human being. And the land of the Kulin stretched from Wilson's Promontory in the east to the Otways, to the foothills of the Otways in the west, and as far north as close to the Murray River. And that area is an enormous block of land in central Victoria. Within that area there were five separate language groups, five groups of people who spoke the same language, five separate languages, or in the usual terminology that people use is a tribe. There were five tribes of people. In Aboriginal society there is a variety of groups. Probably the most significant grouping in Aboriginal society is the clan, and that relates to essentially a family, but not just a small nuclear family. Basically, the people who make up a clan could trace their descent back to a given individual. And the clan in Aboriginal society is the is the landowning group, and a tribe is a group of clans, all of whom claim, all of whom can speak the same language, and whose land, the individual clan estates, join together to make one larger area. So a tribal territory is really composed of a number of smaller areas which we refer to as estates. Now in this particular part of Melbourne, the tribe which lived in the area which is now Melbourne, or the area which now is now covered by Melbourne, was the estate, or consisted of the estates, of two separate tribes. One of them was called Boonwurrung, and I'm sure you've all probably heard of the term Boonwurrung. The Boonwurrung people lived primarily on the Mornington Peninsula, and there were six clans of Boonwurrung speakers, and their territory, their collected estates, stretched from and included Wilson's Promontory and across to and included the Mornington Peninsula, but also included a strip around the top of Port Phillip Bay to as far as the Werribee River. The other area, the other tribe living in the area which is now covered by Melbourne, was the clans of the Woiwurrung. Now, Woiwurrung speakers, there were five clans. One of them, or two of them actually, were called Wurundjeri. There was a Wurundjeri Willem and Wurundjeri Bullock. And they, the Wurundjeri Willem, were the clan which focused on the Yarra River around about this point, and up to and including up on the eastern side of the Saltwater River, the Maribyrnong, up to as far as Mount William. The other Wurundjeri clan, which was Wurundjeri Bullock, were to the south of the Wurundjeri Willem and bordered on their southern edge with the Boonwurrung clans. The way in which, of course, whenever you think of these things and you try and draw them out on paper, you immediately have to adopt an essentially European mode of doing it. We draw lines on maps on paper to show where one boundary was between two groups, but that sort of practice, of course, was not what would have happened in the Aboriginal world. And but the way we can work it out, I guess, is to think of it in terms of drainage basins. The way in which the Boonwurrung and Woiwurrung thought of the line between their territories was where the rivers drained to the south was Boonwurrung, where the rivers drained into the Yarra was Woiwurrung. And if you know your locality very well, and I was surprised to find this when I looked at the Melways earlier today, the boundary is not very far from here. It's probably, in fact, somewhere between Maroondah Highway and Canterbury Road, because if you don't have to go very far before you get to where Dandenong Creek is. And Dandenong Creek, of course, flows to the south. If the river, such as the Kunong Creek, is a tributary of the Yarra, then you're in Woiwurrung territory, more particularly you're in Wurundjeri clan territory, and that of course is where we are now. This would be Wurundjeri Bullock, because the Bullock was between the Wurundjeri Willem and the Boonwurrung. So that's the rule of thumb was what the topography was. There is a point at which the rivers turn and flow the other way, and that by and large Aboriginal territories are based on that sort of drainage basin style. So all of the area drained by the Yarra River and its tributaries, including of course the Maribyrnong, was Woiwurrung territory. Now the five clans who spoke Woiwurrung, for economic purposes, didn't always go around as clan groups, because a clan might consist of perhaps 100 individuals, and on a day-to-day basis, Aboriginal people in this part of, Aboriginal people in fact all over Australia, including this part of Victoria, were what we refer to as hunter-gatherers. They made their living by hunting and gathering. Strictly speaking, we should refer to them as gatherer-hunters, because by and large the women gathered and the men hunted. And I'll speak more about and explain more about that in a moment. But in terms of day-to-day economic exercises, 100 people moving around is really too many. The optimum size of a hunting foraging group is probably about somewhere between 20 and 30 people. So groups tended to split up much more, and they consisted of what, in economic terms and day-to-day functioning terms, we would refer to as a band. So a clan of people, or the Wurundjeri Willem clan in this area would have in most days been found spread right through their estate. There was and working in essentially small groups, which might consist of two or three men and their respective wives. Most men, older men certainly, had at least a couple of wives, and sometimes three and four wives, and so they had children. There also you'll find a number of individual single men who would be travelling with the group for various purposes. The connections between Aboriginal groups are enormously complicated. The people who lived in this part of the Port Phillip region were connected to other groups who lived in the Goulburn River area. The people who lived on the Mornington Peninsula were closely connected to those who lived on the Bellarine Peninsula on the other side of Port Phillip Bay. And the connections that they had were primarily related to marriage revolving around the exchange of women, marriage partners. The reason for this is that, or one reason at least, is that at times when, for whatever reason, whatever climatic reason, there may be a drought or even looking at it in the other way, a seasonal abundance in one area. In a different area, there would be unlikely to be a drought. As you'd be aware, the weather, for instance, and climate generally on the other side of the Dividing Range is different to that we have here. So people who were connected, people such as the Wurundjeri Willem living in this area, who were connected to people who lived in the Goulburn River area, could be sure that if they were facing a bit of a drought, then the chances are their relations, the people to whom they were connected in the Goulburn River, were doing a bit better. And the reverse may be true in other times of the year. So those connections existed to allow people the facility to be able to move somewhere else. And if, for instance, if you lived in an area that had a coastline and whales beached themselves, you would be able to let other people know that there was this sudden abundance of food. And the people that you would let know, of course, were those people who were connected to you by marriage. The other reason for devising a system that meant that you exchange partners a long way away was that it tends to tell against the problems of inbreeding, so that you make your breeding group as large as possible. The rules that that people applied in these sorts of situations were traditional ones. They were laid down by custom and probably relate to stories and, in a sense, myths that had been within the group for perhaps thousands of years and related to the dreaming that people had, so that they were traditional connections. They didn't when somebody had a daughter who was of marriageable age, they didn't think, well, who can I give this woman to, or is there a man around who will marry this woman? It was pretty well set out already that because everybody belonged to a particular group, almost like a religious grouping, and people who were, there were basically two classes of, or two groups of people. One were, these were once again based on dreaming characters. One group was Bunjil and one group was Wah. And people who were Bunjils always married people who were Wah. So if you, and the Wurundjeri Willem, I think from memory, were Bunjil. That was their clan, moiety. And so if I was living in this area and I had a daughter who was of marriageable age, I would give her to a man who was a Wah from as far away as possible. And the furthest away, of course, was in the Goulburn River Valley. So I would find a man who was looking for a young wife who was a Wah, so he was in the right category, and my daughter would then go and live with that man as his wife, and that made a connection. The great advantage of that sort of practice is that not only did I get rid of a daughter who I had to feed, but it provided a dependency with that man. He then owed me something for the rest of my life because I was giving to him a food provider, somebody who would provide food for him as long as she was alive, and so he would owe me a favour, and the favour may be redeemed by allowing me to go and hunt or forage in his territory. And so those connections which were formed by marriage have that practical link and provide for ongoing connections, because that daughter of mine, when she has children, their children will be of the category, in this case, Wah, and so they will be looking for marriage partners, and the likely source of marriage partners will be in the clan from which the mother had come, because you alternate. If she begins as a Bunjil, then her children are Wahs, because that's the group that she's married into. So you have these long-standing and quite long-distance relationships as well that are going on. And people, there were regular meetings of people of different moieties to carry on this sort of business. So regularly you'd have all of the clans of the Kulin Nation meeting at particular spots, and there were places around the Melbourne area that this happened on a regular basis every year or every 6 months. And these were occasions when wives were, or daughters or sisters were given away in marriage, and particular ceremonies were enacted to perpetuate the world as it was, to make sure that the world kept ticking over in the way that it had been, and to affirm and confirm these sorts of links that I've been talking about. So people all over in the central block of Victoria were connected in dozens of different ways, and connected intricately, so that it was of course possible to travel only within that area, because strangely enough, people in the land of the Kulin, they knew everybody in the world. If you met somebody you didn't know, then that person was not recognized even as a human being, because Kulin is the word for human being. Anybody who wasn't one of those five language groups wasn't a human being. He wasn't, or she wasn't, a Kulin at all. So not only couldn't you speak to them, but you wouldn't even recognize them as being a proper human being. It was an us and them sort of distinction. There was another group which operated in exactly the same way, that took up all the area of Gippsland, and these people were called Gunai or Kurnai, and they operated, they had their own links spread right across Gippsland, and they were five or six language groups in that particular nation as well. and these sorts of distinctions that are drawn between Kurnai and Kulin have been quite well documented in historical terms, but also in archaeological terms, because some artefacts which originate in Kulin territory are never found in Kurnai territory. There's a particular type of stone which comes from Mount William up there in the Macedon Ranges, which is never found, and it can be specifically identified according to its composition of elements. And whenever a stone axe is found and it's tested in this way, the material is always found to the west and to the north, but never to the east. It's never found in Gippsland, which suggests, of course, that there was a boundary, that people didn't trade. People who lived in the Port Phillip region didn't trade with people on the other side of the Dandenongs, and that's borne out by all the historical sources, because Kurnai and Kulin were were sworn enemies. They didn't recognise that the members of the other were human beings. I'll show you. We know, as I said at the beginning, quite a lot about Kulin people, primarily because of the historical sources that have been compiled. When Europeans first started to live in the Port Phillip region, of course, the Aboriginal society was operating as it had done for probably thousands of years, but very quickly began to be so disrupted that and people were denied access to traditional sites, to the point where it became extremely difficult to carry on a traditional way of life. Also, of course, Europeans introduced unintentionally, in most cases, diseases which were fatal to Aboriginal people. So the numbers of deaths in Aboriginal society rose very quickly. And that, of course, all of those things meant that Aboriginal society, traditional Aboriginal society in the Port Phillip area, suffered enormous loss. And very quickly, within a matter of about 30 or 40 years, there were very few Aboriginal people living in traditional ways in the Port Phillip region. So it was really that sort of 30-year period that our observations come from, how people were living, the connections that they had, and in some cases, as we'll see now, drawings of individuals. One thing about archaeology is you very rarely get a look at individuals, because it tends to be you're focusing all the time on material culture. So you're excavating stone tools or pieces of material culture that have no names on them, and we're dealing with people who had no written language, so they didn't write their name on in a way that we would recognise. Undoubtedly, there were personal marks that were put on possessions, although possessions were not numerous. I mean, we're dealing with a culture that was not unlike our own, focused entirely on material. In Aboriginal society, there was an enormous focus and a primacy, a major focus put on spiritual values. Material values are considered hardly at all. And this, of course, was one source of puzzlement and simply lack of understanding on the part of Europeans, who saw Aboriginal people and thought, well, these people have got nothing. They live very mean lives. In fact, the Aboriginal people are living incredibly rich lives, both spiritually and materially. So I'll run through a few of the slides. If we can wake Ted up. Some of these, I'll speak to some of these drawings. That first one was a drawing of this man's wife. This man, whose name was Billy Baleri, was the most important man in the Port Phillip area at the time that Europeans arrived. He was the head man of the Wurundjeri Willem clan. Every clan had a head man who was the leader. I mean, Europeans referred to these people as kings and chiefs, but in, the more correct term was head man, because in most instances they had authority. People did what they were told. But in other instances, a man like Billy Valeri would yield his authority to somebody else who might know more about the particular circumstance that was going on. For instance, if there was a hunt for kangaroos, or they were out fishing for eels, there were often people who had, in a sense, specialised in that particular aspect of their culture, and in such circumstances their authority held sway. For ordinary day-to-day activities, Billy Valeri authority was paramount. Every clan of the five clans of the Woiwurrung, the six clans of Boonwurrung, every clan had a head man, sometimes two men. Only men, I'm afraid. There were no head women. Although women had an importance in other ways. I mean, they had authority in other circumstances. But every clan had at least one head man. But of the collected group of head men of the Kulin Nation, Billy Baleri's voice was that was most listened to. He was the most important man of all, and he had authority, the keeping authority, the right to dispose of the material from the Mount William Axe Quarry, an extremely important source of stone, and the one I mentioned earlier about that's always traded to the north and west, an extremely valued commodity. These drawings, these line drawings, were done by William Thomas, who was an assistant protector of Aborigines and the assistant protector for the Melbourne area, Melbourne and Gippsland, but he spent most of his time around Melbourne. Within a matter of about 5 years, he spent almost all his time trying to keep the Aborigines out of the settlement and to keep the keep down the level of conflict that was going on between European and Koori groups. This man is Windberry, who was another important man in the Koori society in the Melbourne region. In 1840, there was an incident when a group of army personnel rounded up all of the Aboriginal people they could find in the Aboriginal camp, which was on the south side of the Yarra, where the botanical gardens now are, and marched them into the stockade. This man was one of them. He objected to being marched along at gunpoint, and he was shot dead, just like that, October 1840. I have the next one. One thing that was interesting about that is that you can see that he has a mixture of material culture. He has a blanket around him, but he's holding his spear and boomerang and shield. This is another drawing. I don't think this one's actually by William Thomas. It doesn't look like his style, but I'm not sure. Another man, Billy, alias Urquhart. Often they took, for reasons of their own, I suppose in an attempt to fit into European society, people would take European names. We have photographs as well. This one's back to front, but it's a photograph of an Aboriginal man from this area, Port Phillip area. You can see that he has entirely traditional material culture. He has a cloak which is probably kangaroo skin, boomerang, a number of long spears, got a headband, waist band, loin covering. Also paintings. This is Jack Weatherly. This is an oil painting that I think hangs in, was part of the State Library picture collection. Once again, a collection of traditional material culture, possum skin cloak, necklace of reed, and a boomerang. There's always, of course, an element of artistic license in these things. What's happened to our slides? There was a there is a particularly fine collection of photographs, not all of which are Aboriginal, but which does include a number of images of Aboriginal people around the Melbourne area, taken in 1856, I think, and this is one of them, and you can see in this case this Aboriginal woman and child, and there's a dog. In the back there, looks remarkably like a European dog, and they're wrapped in blankets or sheets, and they have metal pannikins. So, it was one of the outstanding elements of Aboriginal culture is that it's tremendously adaptable. People have lived in Australia for in excess of 40,000 years. And in that time, in all parts of the continent, have had to adapt to a wide range of changes in climatic circumstance, but also in terms of adapting to the incoming culture of European people. What we find in Melbourne is that Aboriginal people very quickly took up elements that were of use to them. In their culture, and metal pannikins, things like that, which replaced the more traditional wooden pannikins or wooden bowls, was one example, and blankets instead of possum skin cloaks, because they were much easier to get, of course, but B, they did the job just as well, and they fitted these elements into their traditional culture. Thank you. And you can see in that, I don't know whether you noticed in that earlier picture, the woman had a lot of markings across her chest. And I think that, in fact, there is no reason to believe this is so, but I think that photograph is of the same couple that William Thomas drew, the first slide that I showed, because they have similar markings. I just have that sort of feeling. And if so, that would be rather remarkable, in that was Billy Baleri's wife. We have no photograph at all of Billy Baleri himself, only that line drawing. Another photograph from that same collection, which is referred to as the Sun Pictures of Victoria, taken by Antoine Forgeret and Richard Daintree, 1857. And you can see that here some of the women have blankets at the end there. But the young girl at the back here has a possum skin cloak. Likewise, this girl also a intricately woven bag that she's carrying there. Thanks. What we know of how people lived comes, of course, from not only from what we find in archaeological sites, but also in terms of artistic representations of campsites. And here, I think we do get into the realms a bit of artistic license, because you find that in almost every case of a scene like this, there's a dog. Now, there might have been a lot of dogs around, and in fact we know from the early accounts of Melbourne that the number of dogs running around in the streets was an immense problem. There were great packs of hundreds of dogs at a time. But in these sort of essentially idyllic scenes, there's always a dog in a strategic sort of place. And it's part, I think, of the composition of the picture. But the thing to notice in this picture is these things here, which are, and over here we've got at least two varieties of shelter that people created. These ones here are just quite large sheets of bark that have been cut off trees and laid against a framework which can be put up. This sort of construction of camp, if you need to create a habitation of this sort, it could be done in a matter of about an hour. And there was a fair amount of movement in Aboriginal in the Aboriginal day-to-day life, not as much as might be thought, and certainly not of the kind that would suggest that Aboriginal people are nomadic. I mean, nomads are moving for a particular purpose, and it is wrong to think of Aboriginal society as nomadic. They moved, certainly, but they may people may live in the one area. And to give you a quite close example, people lived in the lagoons and swamps of Baleen for a month at a time on their seasonal movements around the area. People, movement in Aboriginal society is purposeful in the sense that it is seasonal and it is for a particular movement towards a particular object or place. It's dictated to some extent by the seasonal availability of resources, but also by the weather. People during summer and spring were more would have been through this area. It's unlikely that people would have been living in this area in winter. And as winter came in, people were moving up the rivers up into the high country. It makes no sense to us to think of people living in the Dandenongs in winter, but in fact there's much more shelter to be had from wind and rain in the Dandenongs than there would be down on the open flat plains of the Yarra River, and it's a place you would not want to be, even with a possum skin cloak on, in winter. Thanks. There are a number of representations of different sorts of camps, and camps in the main are generally, most camp scenes would have been for consisting of a small number of people. Once again, I mean, 20 or 30 people was quite a large group. There's one quite interesting reference in William Thomas's journal about a number of people travelling along. I think there was something like 70 people in the group, and they decided very quickly that there were too many. So they split up into two.